You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Back in June, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was kicked out of the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia because the owner didn't like her association with President Donald Trump's administration. Is this an act of discrimination, perfectly within one's right, or both? Today I'm joined by Dr. Steve Davies, head of education at the IEA, to discuss the concept of civility in public life. Steve argues that any private establishment has the right to refuse service, but that doing so does not come without consequence. We discuss famous instances of discrimination perpetuated by both the private sector and the state, and try to identify what the lines are between civil dissent and dangerously overstepping the mark. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. Steve, thanks for joining me. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was recently kicked out of the Red Hen restaurant in Virginia. She was asked by the co-owner to leave the premises because she did not want to serve her as a representative of the Trump administration, particularly, I think, as it related to issues happening along the border right now and Trump's zero tolerance policy. I've also seen some reports that there were questions about the administration's view of gay rights. And all of this combined, the co-owner asked her to leave. After her meal had been served, she came over and asked her to leave the restaurant. Sarah Sanders did, later tweeted out this experience. What do we make of it? Should the restaurant be shut down? Should the owner be prosecuted? Is this civil liberty in action? What's happening?
Well, this is a very big and complicated issue on the surface of it, but I actually think there are some fairly basic rules of thumb we can use to make sense of it. The first question you ask, the restaurant had the perfect right to do this. Any private establishment, such as this was, has the right to refuse service to any person who comes and asks to be served there without giving a reason. That's part of what being in a private business is. You are not under any obligation to serve anybody who turns up. Now, the question is, therefore, well, were they right to do so in this case? And that raises the question of, is it right to do things like refusing to serve people in restaurants, making your views of people's political activities or role in a government department known to them in response to what they're doing. Now, the point I would make is this. I think that if you believe as a private citizen that the policy that the government is engaging in a particular area is simply unconscionable, that it is, you know, breaking certain kind of rules or lines that you think are, you know, ones that you just should not go beyond, which I believe is what was felt in this case, to do with, as you say, things in the borders and separation of children from parents and things of that sort, then I think not only do you have a right not to serve people, but you have a power, if you will, to tell them firmly and politely, but clearly, that you disapprove of what they're doing. You think it makes them less as a person, that you think less of them as a person because of what they're doing or justifying, and that therefore you're not prepared to engage in business with them. This is social shunning and boycotting, if you will. In one sense, you could say it's the market at work. This is the way in which voluntarily people can use their market position to tell other people that they disagree very strongly with what they're doing, the use of government power that they're engaged in, and send them a message. The question, of course, though, is, first of all, how far does this go? Now, in the case of Sarah Sanders, she's very much the public face of the administration because she's the press secretary, and she is, in some sense, a person with a kind of responsibility. Now, she's not responsible for the actual policy, but she is choosing in her role to publicly defend it and hold out to it. You would similarly feel the same way if you were the owner of that restaurant, I suppose, towards the person in charge of the government agency involved, the ICE, or the Border Control, whatever they're called these days, or the Department of the Interior. On the other hand, I don't think it would be appropriate to take this kind of action towards, let's say, a low-ranking official. You might say to them, well, do you really think you want to keep on doing your job in good conscience? But you shouldn't then not serve them. And you certainly shouldn't extend it to, let's say, Republican voters, or for that matter, in the worst case, Democratic voters or members of the party, because I think that would be crossing a very dangerous line.
You're saying that based on ethics, but based on your principle, you're saying you would definitely be in your right to do so. If someone walks into my shop with a Make America Great Again hat on, you're saying by every right, I certainly don't have to serve them.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you do have that right.
But you're
so you're
saying that right exists for everyone and anyone that you want to discriminate against. But you're saying ethically, there's a clear line between somebody who is actively involved in a policy and somebody who, well, I don't know. I mean, voting for someone, isn't that an act of in support of
indeed,
policy?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's why this is a tough decision. I mean, if you're in Germany in the 1930s, before 1933, let's say, what do you do if somebody walks into your store who's wearing an NSDAP or a KPD badge, you know, who's voting for one of the two totalitarian parties in the state at that time? I think, you might well want to make your feelings about their political inclinations clear at that time. It does become difficult. And obviously, the higher the stakes in politics are, the further down the train, you might say, you have a right or even maybe a responsibility to go. But my view is that, yes, you have a right, but there's two important things. One is that really it should be aimed at people who clearly have some degree of responsibility or public association with the policy that you regard as unconscionable and simply unwarranted. And secondly, the way that you do it is enormously important, because what you should do is express your disagreement and disapprobation of that person very clearly and very firmly, but also formally, politely. What you should not engage in is things like coarse or vulgar abuse, cursing or swearing, basically immature behaviour, I would say. And also, above all, you do not want and never should resort to threats of violence or physical harassment. So, that is beyond the pale, and that's also extremely dangerous.
So I want to come back to sort of the philosophy and the ethics of how one goes about shunning, essentially, other people in society. But to stick on the Sarah Sanders case for a second, and to your point about taking it too far, after this occurred, Congresswoman Maxine Waters came out and had this little mini rally in which she called for more attacks, essentially, on Trump officials. She then doubled down on MSNBC, and I have a quote for her from her here. She says, "The people are going to turn on them. They're going to protest. They're going to absolutely harass them until they decide that they're going to tell the president, no, I can't hang with you." Calls for harassment, I mean, that's crossing a line now, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, I think her initial remarks indicated simply that you should let people know how you feel, which is fair enough. And there are all sorts of ways in which you can do that, quite frankly. You can write letters to your congressman. You can, you know, have public demonstrations. There's the whole paraphernalia of democratic discourse through which you can do that, as well as face-to-face contact. But then talking about harassment, I think, is stepping over that very important line, because that implies something much more aggressive, something much more close to violence or actively violent. And I think that's extremely dangerous. And the point about that is, what you should think about here is not only that that is wrong in itself, but that also this could redound against you. Now, I'm not a Christian and I don't often quote the man himself, but it's worth remembering, I think, one of the things that Jesus said at the point when he was actually being arrested by the Sanhedrin's guards in the Garden of Gethsemane to be taken off to face trial and execution. And Peter cut off one of the soldier's ears, and Jesus said to him, "Put up your sword, Simon Peter, and return it to its sheath, for all they that take the sword shall perish by the sword." And the point of that biblical quote and the message that it sends is that if you resort to violence and that kind of extreme step that Maxine Waters was hinting at there, then it's going to happen to you as well eventually. That's the way to destroy civilized democratic discourse and replace it with a completely fractured and dysfunctional kind of political argument, which could even end up in violence or in some historical context, civil war.
Absolutely. I think there's consensus that she really did take it too far. But it's worrying, right, that we jump from essentially the right to discriminate, the right to reject somebody for service, to all of a sudden someone feeling like it's okay to say, yeah, reject them, and then harass them and follow it up. And it represents that polarization in American politics that doesn't seem to be reclining or going backwards anytime soon.
Well, a couple of things to say about that. One is that it's important to realise this kind of polarisation in American politics is not new. This has happened quite a few times before. In the 1800 election, for example, quite a lot of the Federalist propaganda was quite literally and seriously claiming that Thomas Jefferson was the Antichrist, and that if he won the election, it meant that the rule of the great beast 666 was about to be instantiated. They really meant
that
it.
That seems reasonable.
And if you, as I'm sure you may recall from, you know, high school history lessons, there was the infamous occasion in the 1850s when Congressman Preston Brooks from South Carolina walked into the Senate chamber in Washington and with his walking stick thrashed Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts so severely that he was in danger of dying and actually could not attend Senate meetings for 2 years, I believe it was, after that, after which he, Preston Brooks that is, was then feted as a hero in his native state. So this kind of political polarisation and outright violence is something that there is a history of. However, that does not mean that we should take it lightly. I mean, in fact, that particular case shows why we shouldn't take it lightly, because a few years after Brooks did that, of course, there was an actual shooting war in the United States that went on to kill more than 500,000 Americans. That is the kind of thing that can happen when political discourse breaks down. Now, the thing is, it's one thing to have strong disagreements. It's one thing to express those disagreements vociferously, loudly, and openly. But what you need to do, and what you should not forget, is to do this in a way that conforms to formal norms of politeness. And I think the problem at the moment is not so much that there's strong disagreement or political polarization, it's that, and not only in the United States, we appear to have forgotten how to express strong and deeply felt disagreements in a way that is observes the norms of formal courtesy and civility. I suppose what we need is to relearn the ancient English art of being quite rude to people while being formally polite at the same time.
It was Congressman Steve Scalise who was shot at the baseball match, the friendly baseball match for representatives, who also tweeted out, you know, this is clearly not the way that we should handle these situations, because it's already on our doorstep. This violence is already there, and it's not something we want to stoke. I want to go back to sort of the ethics and the philosophy of discriminating, because especially in American history, it is uncomfortably recent that discrimination was used against those who were of a different ethnic background. Black people were clearly discriminated against, you know, less than 100 years ago. This is very, very recent, that they couldn't use the same bathrooms. They couldn't sit at the front of the bus. They couldn't use the same water fountain. And so I think it, you know, it makes people very uncomfortable. And you get into, you know, very strange territory when you start talking about the right to discriminate. The case I'm thinking of very recently, just in June, upheld by the Supreme Court, was the case of the baker in Colorado who refused to bake a gay wedding cake. Now, Colorado pushback on him, but it went to the Supreme Court and it was decided 7-2 that the baker's rights should be upheld, that he was should not be forced to bake that wedding cake.
It's worth saying a couple of things actually about that specific case that the Supreme Court decided. One of the things was that the baker in question made it very clear that he had no problem whatever in serving gay customers, in providing them with cakes and any other one of the products he made. What he objected to was a cake with a particular kind of message on it or associated with a particular function of which he, as a believer, did not think was valid, like a gay marriage, in fact. Now, the point about there is that he's not discriminating against an entire class of people. He's basically saying that there are certain services, specific services, that he's not prepared to provide. And that's one of the reasons why the Supreme Court actually upheld his case. The other reason, which I think Justice Kagan made very clear in her part of the judgment, was that the Colorado board, which had brought the case against him in the first case, through its minutes and other records, quite clearly made it obvious that they were motivated by religious animus. And therefore, there was a case of discrimination, if you like, against him because of his beliefs. And so the Supreme Court, and this is why I think it was a 7-2 verdict, felt that, well, even if you did think that the state had a right to compel people to provide services, you should not be doing so in a way which is then reversely discriminating against another group. So that was the kind of case that Justice Kagan made. So that's obviously a very important consideration. Now, my own view is that you do have a right as a private citizen, as a person engaged in private business, not to serve certain people and not to provide certain services. Now, There are many examples of this. For example, if you are a devout Sabbatarian or if you're an Orthodox Jew, then you have a right not to provide certain services that take place on the Sabbath, for example, or services involving things which are ritually, you know, unclean for you, pork. Similarly, if you're a devout Muslim, you know, you don't have to sell pork products. You have a right not to do it. The public don't have a right to come in and demand that you provide them with pork scratchings, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been questions about supermarket attendants not wanting to sell alcohol.
That's a question, therefore, for the employer. The employer then has to make a straightforward decision about whether or not they want to compel the employee to do this or fire them, which I think they would have a right to do in that case. You might say, well, this is part of your duty. Therefore, when you take on the job, you have to be prepared to do that. If you aren't prepared to do this, then you need to find a job elsewhere. That's also a perfectly appropriate thing. But it's also appropriate for the person to say, well, I'm not comfortable with doing this, and seek some other kind of employment within the place. The thing is, we all have rights as private individuals not to do certain things, not to serve certain people, to express our feelings towards certain people by either shunning them, refusing to associate with them, or refusing to provide them with a service. Now, the question, and this is where I think your historical allusions to things like Jim Crow come to bear, is what if the refusal in question constitutes a refusal to serve not a particular person or a narrowly defined kind of product, but an entire category of people, let's say African Americans, or maybe religious believers, or Jewish people, or immigrants. There are any number of people who have been the victim of this kind of prejudiced attitude in the past. Now, my own view, which is unpopular, I think, is that actually you should have the right to do that, but you should then expect very significant pushback. So if I, for example, heard that there was a private firm which was, as a matter of principle, if you want to call it that, refusing to serve gay people or Muslims or black people, I would not only refuse to patronise that establishment myself, but I would actively organise other people to also boycott it. That is the free market at work. That is how it does it. I'm afraid a lot of the people who assist on this right to discriminate or right of free association then get very upset when other people push back and say, oh, in that case, we are going to lobby for other people not to use your services. They can't have it both ways. That's also free association. And finally, it's worth saying something in that connection, which is, why did Jim Crow exist? Why did the Southern legislatures have to pass all these laws? They had to pass them because lots and lots of Southern white businessmen were engaging in free commercial transactions with freed ex-slaves, African Americans. They couldn't depend upon what they were otherwise using, which is private sector persuasion, to try to stop them doing it. So they had to resort to the law. And indeed, even more to the point, they had to resort to extra legal measures, the kind of intimidation and threats of violence that organisations like the KKK brought to bear on any business that actually broke the rules that they wanted them to follow. Now, that's a case where I actually think that the intervention of the federal government was justified, because the market, the process I just described, was not being allowed to work because of the threat of violence.
Yeah, it wasn't a market.
It wasn't a market at all. It was being undermined by both public violence in the shape of the Jim Crow laws and the threat of violence from extrajudicial sources. So my view is, yes, you do, as a level of philosophy, have a right to not serve people, but you must expect pushback. And if you have an open society in which the right of people is respected and threats of private violence are not tolerated or allowed, then in fact I imagine that pushback in the current context would have an effect pretty quickly.
In a very strange way, because I actually didn't know that, Steve, in a very strange way, that's quite optimistic, that when you give people freedom, their prejudices usually fade away. They're not ingrained. And that you have to use force often in order to stop people from engaging with each other regardless of what they look like.
Well, there's two reasons for that, one of which is optimistic, the other perhaps cynical. The cynical explanation for what I've just described is that even people who are very prejudiced also like money. And so they have a strong financial incentive to swallow their prejudice and serve that person that they don't like. But the more optimistic explanation is that actually even people who are bigoted and prejudiced against other kinds of human beings in general very often find it very hard to be bigoted and prejudiced towards specific individual human beings that they interact with. Mm-hmm. And that is what, more than anything else, tends to undermine entrenched prejudice. Now, there are always going to be some bigoted assholes, to use the blunt word for them. They will not be able to get their way and force other people, ultimately, in a free society, to go along with them unless they have access to force, either through the state or through private extrajudicial means.
Right. A lot of this reminds me of the free speech conversations we've had before, Steve, because a lot of people assume that the right to free speech means that you're never going to have any pushback. I can say what I want, and that's it. You can't touch me. You can't say anything. You can't belittle me. It's my opinion. That's fine. No, no. The right to free speech means you can say what you want. And the right to everybody else's free speech is that they can pummel your ideas into the ground, especially if they're bad ones.
Yes, exactly.
And absolutely the same is true on the discrimination front. If I knew that there was a shop that wouldn't sell a wedding cake to a gay couple, I not only wouldn't go there, I'd make sure that nobody I knew did.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely it. And that is actually the free market and free association at work. So I think there's quite frankly some rank hypocrisy going on with people who say, oh, they're all in favour of free association, basically so that they can exercise their prejudices, and then they don't expect they're going to get any pushback.
And I want to finish by talking about the politics of what's happened to Sarah Sanders, because you have to know when to use this right to discriminate. Definitely from a public perspective, you want this to pan out in your favor. And I think there's been a very mixed reaction to what happened at the Red Hen restaurant. I've seen plenty of articles saying, well done, way to, you know, push back on the Trump administration. I've seen a lot more that say, this woman was just trying to have a meal, and you kicked her out of your restaurant. And if you're going to do this, you want the public response to be on your side. And I suspect, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the midterm elections in America. Certainly no idea what will happen in 2020. A big constituency that's thought to be in flux about how they feel are conservative women, especially married women, about whether or not they'll potentially stick with their Donald Trump vote or go elsewhere. You know, if you see a woman being kicked out of a restaurant, it doesn't really matter who she's working for. That feels a bit funny, because you think, would I like to be humiliated like that and kicked out of a restaurant because of opinions that I had? And I think that can backfire.
It can do, but that depends on what the climate... Two things. It depends, first of all, on what the climate of public opinion is. Now, at the moment, in this particular context in the United States, the climate is extremely polarized. And therefore, I suspect at this point, there aren't that many people who are actually, you might say, neutral and undecided. There aren't that many waverers who are going to be either put off or persuaded. Rather, what's going on is a kind of sorting out process in which people are really being forced, in a way, to declare which side of the divide they're on. And I'm afraid that's what happens in the early stages of really profound political divisions of one kind or another. So I think in some sense, the kind of tactical concerns you're talking about, which are actually very important, are less important now than they might be, say, a few years down the line or have been in other periods. The other thing, though, is that, to go back to the point I made earlier, it's the way that you do it that is important here. Because if you do it in a way which is perceived to be humiliating or violent or aggressive or disdainful, or to imply that a whole category of your fellow citizens are moral reprobates of one kind or another, then yes, indeed, you are going to shoot yourself in the foot. You're going to have, you know, taken up the sword, and you're probably going to die by the sword. On the other hand, if you do it, and I admit this is often very difficult, in a way that is forceful but polite, then you're more likely to hopefully raise the issues and make at least a few people somewhere think about what is going on, what is the actual policy that you're objecting to, and why are people so mad about it, and then maybe start a more reasonable discussion. I would add finally, actually, that if you are really mad at what politicians do, one of the most effective things to do, actually, is to ridicule them. Making fun of politicians is something which is often much more effective than the kind of thing we've been talking about here, which is expressing your moral disapproval. And heaven knows there are enough features of the current US administration, and indeed a lot of other administrations, such as the one we have here in the UK, which lend themselves to ridicule.
And we know that the President of the United States does not like to be mocked.
No, indeed.
So I think that would, really, really dig in deep. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Thank you.
For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.